Welcome back to the Series 7 Study Guide. My name is Franz. Today we have an interview with Bela Musitz. Bela is a professor of entrepreneurship, and he's going to tell you about his background in the interview. This interview went well. The content was good, but we had some technical difficulties. We did the interview over Skype, and Skype kept cutting out on us. So I would be talking, or he would be talking, and suddenly we would lose connections, and he would continue to talk, or I would continue to talk until we realized there was nobody on the other side listening to us. And so multiple times during this interview, we had to go in and try to pick up where we thought we left off. Eventually, I had to give him a call on the landline, and at that point in time, you can tell that the audio quality deteriorates significantly. And that's why I like to do my interviews on Skype. I would like to do more podcasts on topics that you think would be valuable for you. I don't want to give away the full series of audio lessons, but I may pepper some of the audio lessons or portions of the audio lessons in future podcasts. But I would really like to get input from you as to what topics you would like me to cover for the Series 7 Study Guide, for the Series 7 podcast. If you have topics you would like to have covered, email me, franz@series7podcast.com. If you have suggestions for people that I should interview, I would be glad to reach out to them. If you have information that you would like to share that would be valuable to those who are seeking to pass the Series 7 exam and become licensed, then contact me as well. So the Series 7 Study Guide is basically a sample of the audio lessons I put out in the full Series 7 Study Guide course. And as you know, in October of 2018, there was a major change to the FINRA Series 7 exam, where there now is a co-exam that must be passed. And initially, I thought that this exam had to be passed prior to taking the Series 7 exam. But it turns out that you can take the Securities Industry Essentials exam first or second or in conjunction with the Series 7 exam, the new Series 7 exam, or the top-off Series 7 exam, whatever you want to call it. So either way, you still have to pass both exams before you can be licensed to sell securities in the United States. To get more information on the full series of audio lessons for the Series 7 top-off exam or the new Series 7 exam, go to series7podcast.com and you can get all the information that I have there, including the table of contents. And also I put links in the show notes for this podcast. All right, without any further ado, let's get on to the interview with Bela Musitz. I'm on Skype with Bela Musitz. Bela Musitz has been on my other podcast, Sailing in the Mediterranean and Beyond. He's an avid sailor. But he also has his own podcast, which is called The Uncommon Path. And in this podcast, he talks about entrepreneurial activity and other areas of interest to the entrepreneur and the small business person. And I wanted Bela to come onto this podcast, even though this is a bit of a detour from the Series 7 exam. I wanted to have him come on and just talk about business in general, and the things that you may come across in your career as a stockbroker or investment advisor. Because let's face it, most of your clients are going to have made their money doing something other than playing in the stock market. They're going to make their money from being a businessman and selling out their business, or just saving money and putting a nest egg together. But one of the areas that I find fascinating, and I've talked about this in previous podcasts, is my involvement in an angel investment group. I'm involved in SLC Angels, and we invest in startup companies as a group. And Bela has been involved in that activity both as an investor, having managed funds, as I recall, and also an entrepreneur yourself. So Bela, introduce yourself and
Thank you, Franz. Thanks for having me and inviting me to this podcast as well. Most recently, I've been and still am a professor of innovation and entrepreneurship at Clarkson University, which is a relatively small private university in upstate New York. And prior to that, I was one of three co-founders of a venture fund where we did seed and early stage investing. And so we, you know, founded the fund, we raised the fund, we did investing. And then prior to that, I worked at a couple of large companies, namely IBM and General Electric, in their research and development centers. And I also started a couple of venture-backed businesses, one that went out of business and one that I took public in late 96. So a fair amount of experience in these areas, and I'm looking forward to having a great conversation about it.
All right. Well, let's go down the path of how you got involved in entrepreneurial activities to begin with. How did that develop?
Well, so that's a good question. So I was working at GE Research at their R&D labs, and I was working in the area of robotics and automation. And I met two other individuals at a conference that happened to be American Society of Mechanical Engineers conference. And we sat next to each other at dinner, and we were chatting. And these two other individuals had been thinking about starting a business. And one of them was sort of a marketing person. The other one was a finance person. And I was really the propeller head or the engineer. And, you know, it literally started on the back of a napkin, an idea for this business and the product. And one thing led to another. About 3 months later, I handed in my badge at General Electric and left GE and went and joined these two other individuals to start this company. And that was in 1979. And we raised $3.5 million in venture capital from the very first investor we talked to. So I said, wow, this is easy. this is not hard at all. Well, it turns out, as they say, timing is everything. So our product was an industrial robot. And in the span of a month in 1979, the cover story on Business Week and Time Magazine was how industrial robotics was going to save the manufacturing base in the United States. And here's three guys walking around with a business plan to start an industrial robotics company. So we raised a, like I said, $3.5 million from Warburg and Pincus, which is a pretty well-known, relatively large private equity firm. And we spent all the money and went out of business 2 years later. So that was sort of an interesting story, an interesting path along that way.
When you're investing in startups, that's the risk you run. I mean, that's a high risk, high return investing. How did your investor Warburg Pincus take that? Any problems?
Well, no. I mean, if you're in the seed and early stage investing business, you realize that on some number of your investments, you're going to lose everything, and you sort of need to build that into your business model. So you understand that we're going to get a couple of zeros here, folks. And I think in the seed and early stage investing, and by seed and early stage, I mean companies that are just starting, they're typically pre-revenue companies, or they have, you know, less than $1 million in revenue. And when we started, all we had was a business plan and three people. So we had an idea. So I think that if you look at the numbers for the success rate of those types of businesses, about half of them don't make it. So as a seed or early stage investor, you need to sort of build that into your business plan. That's why you have to have those large returns on the ones that are successful, because they have to make up the zeros that you generate on the ones that go out of business.
Yeah, and in my investing, I always expect if it's going to go, I expect at least a 10x return, and really I prefer a 20x return because, like you say, so many of them return zero. And I don't think a lot of entrepreneurs understand that. They always think they're the ones that are going to go through the roof, not realizing that a lot of them go to zero. That's been my experience. I've had one company that I've invested in as an angel investor that so far, and I've only been angel investing for about 5 years, but they raised a good round and they had a good idea. It was a new breast pump, portable breast pump primarily for women. And they burned through their cash and got a product out on the market, but then couldn't support it and ended up closing down. So we had to write that investment off.
And angel investing is oftentimes even more risky than your traditional earlier seed stage venture capital investor. Because oftentimes it's the angel investor that writes that first check, you know, 100,000, maybe a half million total, to get a company off the ground. So oftentimes the angel investors are the ones that are really taking the biggest risks. And hence, they need to generate, as you said, you know, 10 to 20x returns. Otherwise, the economics just doesn't work.
Right. Right. I always say angel investors are the original fools. And the public stock market, it's all based on greater fools.
Yes. Well said. Well said, Franz.
Yeah. Because we are actually putting true equity into a company. And a publicly traded company only gets an equity into the business, either in venture rounds, angel rounds, or when the company goes public. And other than that, it's just the greater fool that is buying and selling the stock. So, yeah, the secondary market. That one failed. And
yes.
Did you ever have any products that came out of that ultimately were sold or were developed later on?
Oh, yeah, we did. So we actually sold product. But we didn't sell enough of them to sort of, you know, sustain the business. So I would say that the most important lesson that at least I learned there, and again, I was the tech guy, I was the engineer, was that the very first time that we talked to a customer, or I should say a potential customer, was when we were exhibiting our product at a trade show, which if you think about it, is too late. Because your product's already done. And so we got the product about 80, 85% right, and which unfortunately wasn't sufficient to keep the business alive. So, you know, the real lesson there, and this is one that stayed with me and I continue to talk to it and teach about it, is this notion of getting input from potential customers early and getting a minimum viable product out as soon as possible.
You know, I've been reading a book on entrepreneurial law, and one of the things that it's been talking about in the chapter I've been reading is exactly what you did. You got together with some friends and started up a company, and you were working for General Electric Research at the time, and one of the things this points out is you need to make sure you're not taking any ideas or innovations that might be in the ownership of your employer. Did you have to deal with anything like that when you started your business?
So we got a clean slate on that regard. And I somehow knew enough, I think from taking a business law class in graduate school, that I needed to make sure that I was not somehow encumbered or you know, going to go do something at this new venture that will conflict or cause some problems further on. And that's important for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's important because if there's a suit from General Electric to your little startup company, your little startup company now is fundamentally radioactive, and it's going to be almost impossible to raise capital. Whether you're right or wrong doesn't matter. You just instantly become radioactive. Because investors have lots of choices and they'll go invest someplace else. And the other reason it's important is that if one of the things an investor is going to ask for before they make an investment is to make sure that the intellectual property that the company is using is, number one, owned by the company. So you have to make sure, for example, the employees of the company sign over their intellectual property that they invent as part of their work to the company. And you're still the inventor, but the invention is assigned to the company. So these investors will do due diligence, and this is one area that they will spend a fairly significant time on, because they too do not want to make an investment and then, you know, 4 weeks later get a letter from the General Electric's attorney or any large company's attorney. I don't mean to be picking on GE, but to say that, hey, we think you're using some of our intellectual property, and now all of a sudden, you know, that venture capitalist investment is radioactive, and it's probably going to, you know, drain all the resources and not be a successful investment.
Yeah. So that's something even angel investors are very, very aware of, because a lot of times it's the founder that's come up with the idea. He's formed a corporation, and you need to make sure he's assigned the rights to that intellectual property to the corporation before you make an investment in that. So that was your first venture. What happened after that?
Well, after we went out of business there, I was fortunate enough to get a position at IBM Research at their corporate R&D labs. And I worked there for 9 years, and 9 years it was. And I went there as an individual contributor, as an engineer technology guy. And got rose through the ranks, got some great management and leadership training while I was there, and also invented something there that was very important to IBM internally, but also had some uses outside of IBM. And the stars aligned inside of IBM. The person that was running IBM Research at that time was a person by the name of Jim McGrady. And he realized that at a corporate research lab, you have a lot of smart people inventing all sorts of things. Some of them have value to IBM and others less so. And he wanted to try to figure out a way of monetizing some of these things that might have value to others. So I was actually working for him when this transpired. And we decided to take this technology and spin it out of IBM as a separate business. So what happened was IBM gave the company that I started a license for this technology, a fully paid up license, royalty-free license, for use in the medical space. So it was confined to a specific set of applications. And IBM also did the initial capitalization for that business. They actually invested $3 million in the business for a 49% share of the business. And I handed in my IBM badge to go run this business. And this business was in the robotic surgical business. And we started that business. And this is circa 1990, and the business was located in California. So I moved my family to California, and we were out there for a number of years. And I was running that business. We were successful. We sold a fair number of products and went public in late 96. So that went quite well. And soon after the public offering, I left the business. The difference between running a public business, a public entity, and a private one is gargantuan. And most of that difference are things that I do not enjoy doing, which I learned very quickly. And so I decided to leave the business. And but that we raised there, we raised the initial $3 million was from IBM, and then we raised an additional $14 million in two separate rounds from other venture capitalists and private equity investors. So there was a total of $17 million raised there before we went public.
And when you went public, how much did you raise at that point in time?
We raised on the order of $60 million.
Did any of the initial investors get out in the IPO? Because sometimes you have the option of selling your stock in an IPO as well. Did you do that?
Most of the times there's a lockup period mm-hmm. for some of those investors, and there was at this offering. The lockup period is a negotiated deal. Lockup, by lockup, it means that current investors in the company and employees cannot sell their shares until a certain amount of time transpires. And I think our lockup period was 12 months, if I remember correctly. So there was a holding period. and that makes, you know, a certain amount of sense to do that. And but so, yeah, that's how that worked.
Did you eventually sell all your stock in that company, or do you still own some of it?
No, I sold it all. I sold it relatively soon after my lockup was over. Excuse me. And that company has since gone out of business.
Oh, okay.
That was a wise move, it turns out.
So this ended part one of the interview with Balaam Usitz. This interview is going to be broken up into probably three different portions because I'm trying to keep the length of the interview about 22 minutes in length, which pretty much matches up with a typical commuter's time to listen to a podcast. In the next interview, we talk about more of Bela's background and also how he starts getting into becoming an angel investor himself. If you have any thoughts or comments or questions, feel free to write me, Franz@Series7Podcast.com, and go to the website, Series7Podcast.com, and check out the audio products to help you prepare for the Series 7 exam. Thanks for listening.